Is Trump getting his immunity, and are campus protesters getting what they deserve? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Maddie Kearns, and the lapidary Ramesh Panuru. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Patriot Voices Made In and the Free the Economy podcast. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. And if you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So Ramesh, we had the oral arguments over Trump's immunity claim, primarily related to the January 6th case, but obviously would apply to other cases as well. And when the Supreme Court first said it was going to take this up, there's a lot of huffing and puffing. There's nothing to see here. There's nothing to argue about. And I was pretty dismissive initially about the idea of any sort of post-presidency immunity for the president as well. And when John Sauer, Trump's attorney, started going, and Clarence Thomas's first question in that booming resonance voice was, where does this immunity come from? I was like, okay, he's going to get destroyed. But then as time went on, I was like, I think he's making at least some sense. And the justices, I think particularly Gorsuch, are like, this question is getting narrowed, because the Jack Smith lawyer was admitting there are kind of core presidential responsibilities where you probably have some sort of immunity there. He was loath to use the word immunity. And Trump's lawyer admitted, maybe without Trump wouldn't approve if he was aware of this, that a lot of, or at least a number of the aspects of the Jack Smith case go to private conduct and would not be protected. But what did you make of it?
Well, I think that the contours of presidential immunity are genuinely unsettled and raise difficult questions, partly because, as Justice Thomas was suggesting in his initial remark, there's nothing explicit in the Constitution about its even existing. It's something that has to be inferred from the Constitution. And the court is in a tricky position here because, you know, its job is to settle the case that's in front of it, but particularly when it comes to this kind of issue, it's also a kind of inescapably playing a kind of policymaking role. It's considering the arguments about the pros and cons of different conceptions of presidential immunity, and it can't just think about the facts of the instant case. The justices have to think about, you know, what possible abuses a broad or a narrow reading of presidential immunity could entail. And so it didn't surprise me, actually, that the court took it up in the first place. It's also, just to give one idea of the sort of the complexity of the issue, if you think about those policy arguments, they become more plausible the more prosecutors are allowed to insist on expansive readings of criminal laws, which is, of course, an issue in one of the other cases that the court has taken up about the January 6th defendants.
The obstruction.
And they're less plausible to the extent that you've got crisply defined, obvious and predictable rules that are written in the criminal law.
Yeah, so Maddie, a lot of the commentary on the left about this is, oh my God, you've screwed up totally our timing to get this case done before the election, because there's a lot of speculation that the court will remand this to the judge in the January 6th case and say, hey, so why don't you disaggregate what's the official duties that are involved here, and we can put those aside, and what's the private conduct, and you can move forward on those. And that would be one sort of a complex task inherently, but then two would be appealable, and Trump could go right back up the ladder appealing whatever decisions she makes, and it would just be totally implausible. And it's kind of hard on any reasonable basis to see this case, I think, going forward as it is. I mean, starting in August or whatever it is, I think still be ridiculous. But the take on the left basically is, don't bore us with the legal details. Don't bore us with what you think might be the consequences going forward. Please, let's get this thing done in a couple months.
Yeah, so I think that criticism misunderstands the role of the court. The court is not there to follow presidential cycles and get things done on politicians' timeline. Of course, they do weigh these things and take into consideration something's timely nature, but they're there to look at the details. And this is a very complicated issue. You know, I think we can intuit that the argument that Trump's making, that he has absolute immunity from criminal prosecution, is unpersuasive. And we can also intuit that Jack Smith's argument that he has no more immunity than any other citizen is also not persuasive. The truth clearly lies somewhere in the middle. But as Ramesh suggested, actually what that looks like in application to the facts of this case are difficult. The key point that came out, I think, in the arguments was that the recognition of presidential immunity and the decision of how that applies and to what extent has much more to do with just Trump. This caution was brought out, I think, by quite a few of the justices. Michael Dreeben, the lawyer for the Smith team, tried to insist that the prosecution would not open the floodgates to other criminal charges against future ex-presidents. But Alito was skeptical of that. He said that this could have a destabilizing effect on democracy. Gorsuch, as you said this was writing a rule for the ages. Kavanaugh said something similar. Even Chief Justice Roberts said that if we were to remove the official, the acts rather than the personal, it's sort of like removing the legs from a stool. You end up with a one-legged stool, which again suggests that there's some skepticism there. I think I was struck by something Justice Thomas said, where he said that other presidential acts in the past that might have seemed ripe for prosecution under the argument that Dreeben's forwarding clearly did not occur. And I think it was David Rivkin and Elizabeth Foley in the Wall Street Journal gave some examples of that. So Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, but he wasn't prosecuted for false imprisonment, false arrest, kidnapping. Harry Truman seized domestic steel plants during the Korean War. You know, nobody was suggesting that he'd committed conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States, which is the charges obviously Smith has brought against Trump. And then even just straightforward military actions that arguably usurped Congress. I mean, are Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, Biden, are they to be prosecuted for murder, torture, war crimes? So clearly you can see how this could get out of hand. But on the other hand, you know, I think it was maybe Sotomayor who brought up the question of whether Trump could legally kill a political rival. And again, that shows the opposite extreme of this and why it is such a difficult ruling and such an important ruling, and one that they do need to spend their time on to get right.
So, Charlie, the example that came up again and again, it was mentioned at the very top, I think, by John Roberts and other justices brought it up as well, is the example of bribery, which involves what even Dreeben, the Jack Smith lawyer, admitted as kind of a core official duty of the president, appointing. So you'd appoint an ambassador, but you do it in return for a bribe. So that's clearly a crime. Taking a bribe is a private act, but the inherent to this crime is an official act. How do you think about that one?
So I am, from the ground up, completely unpersuaded by this argument, and I'm irritated that the Supreme Court seems to be interested in thinking through the consequences as if it's Congress rather than an Article III branch. And I'll explain what I mean by this. I think that there are consequences from the Constitution's text that we might dislike for presidents when they are in office, and then consequences from the Constitution's text for presidents when they're out of office. And I think that those are not the judiciaries to clean up. The way I see this is this. As a matter of structure, presidents while in office are immune from prosecution federally, not at the state level, because they are in charge of the apparatus of prosecution at the federal level. We don't need a ruling to make that clear. We can just look at how our government is structured. The executive branch enforces the law. The executive branch would therefore, while the president were in office, be obliged to enforce the law against the president. The president can stop that.
Prosecuting itself, in effect.
Right. The president, whether he should or not, can stop that. I believe the president is in charge of the Article 2 branch. That is his role. He's the democratically elected figure. If we have an Article 2 branch that operates independently of the president, then we've lost that democratic control. So can the president fire anyone under him who wants to bring a case against him, even if it's ironclad? Yes. What can we do about that? Well, we can impeach him. You mentioned bribery. Clearly, bribery is included within the list of impeachable offenses, even in the narrowest conception of impeachment, which is actually not particularly well cabined. It's not as if the president is immune. Congress would get rid of him. People keep asking this question, well, what if the president assassinated a rival? Well, I think Congress would impeach him. That would be pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the question of the president when he's out of office. Where in the Constitution does it confer any exemption from federal law to people who have been president? It doesn't. Now, does that mean that, as some people have suggested, we might end up in a banana republic-style situation where the new president goes after the old president? Yeah, it does. What can we do about that? Well, a couple things. First off, we can elect good people. Beyond that, we can ask Congress to clarify statutes and rules to determine to whom they apply, to try and stop this within federal law. I don't think under an originalist reading of the 14th Amendment, you would have an equal protection case if Congress said, look, there are certain laws from which somebody who has been president and who has acted while he was president cannot be charged. These aren't questions for the judiciary. The judiciary is not supposed to be sitting here cleaning up all of the potential political consequences of the Constitution as it's actually written. They're supposed to be enforcing it. I just don't think this is a difficult question. No, the president does not constitutionally have immunity from federal law. Yes, while he is in office, he can prevent himself from being prosecuted. No, while he is out, he can't, but Congress can. That's my view of it.
So, Charlie, and what are your thoughts then on the clear statement rule, which came up, which is the argument basically that if a statute doesn't explicitly say that it applies to the president of the United States, it doesn't apply to the president of the United States. Now, there's subtleties and caveats, like all of these things, but that's it in its essence. That would I assume that's not you would not be bored on that either.
Well, look, there's textualism and then there's originalism. And originalism is important because the text means or should mean what it meant at the time of its adoption. If there is profound evidence that suggests that at the time at which the Constitution was written, that rule was considered to be the consensus of those who ratified it, then fine. But if that's a rule that has popped up over time, if that's some canon of construction that was invented by the Supreme Court in the 20th century, as a great deal of them were, then I'm not persuaded by it. No, then I want to go back to the text and I want to go back to the original meaning. I do think there are some interesting questions in general that arise out of who is named and who is not. The 14th Amendment case we had recently, the insurrection case that was 9-0, brought up some of those inquiries. Why did it mention this officer and not that officer? What was the meaning of officer at the time? And so on and so forth. But this one seems a lot more murky to me. And because of that, I would rather that the court says, we have no instruction on this from the Constitution, from the debates, from the Federalist Papers, from those who immediately applied it. And therefore, this is a question for the political branches.
Yeah. So my understanding is the clear statement rule has just been an OLC opinions.
Right.
And yeah, and it hasn't shown up in anywhere.
And there was no OLC in 1789, as far as I know.
Yeah. So
Well, the court has, if I remember correctly, the court has read the Administrative Procedure Act not to cover the president, even though it's not explicitly said in the APA, just because it's trying to avoid the potential of a constitutional problem. It's following a statutory construction rule of constitutional avoidance. Avoid a problem if you can.
I mean, that's of course correct, but the Administrative Procedure Act was passed in 1946 and was really a way of trying to reconcile what FDR did to the Constitution with the Constitution. I would rather that they had just struck all that down and tried to clean it up, which is, I suppose, my point. I just see here the Supreme Court asking all sorts of very good political, practical questions that it's not actually their job to remedy.
Let me slightly change the subject, just because I think there's an underappreciated connection to the argument about prosecuting Trump for trying to obstruct an official proceeding. And there, the question would also be, should this be applied to a president? And it's independent of the question, although related to the question, of whether there's presidential immunity. And you can see the flip side of this. If you have, let's say, an investigation by a House committee, and the minority party in the House is essentially doing everything it can to shut down this proceeding and obstruct it, then can they be charged as trying to obstruct an official proceeding? And I think the intuitive answer to this would be you just can't apply it to the legislature without sort of invading legislative responsibilities that are spelled out in Article 1. And there might be a similar argument about Article 2.
So, Ramesh, it strikes me that both cases here, both sides sort of spin out slippery slope, kind of extreme arguments. So it's not as though, you know, when Trump does something that's arguably illegal or kind of murky, he's going to be stopped in his tracks as president and not be able to do it because some prosecutor is going to prosecute him. He's not going to be prosecuted while he's president. So we're talking about a chilling effect. And the opposite slippery slope is that, well, gosh, you know, you let this happen to Trump, it's going to happen to everyone. And you know, I maybe see more to that. Dreeben was saying, well, this was only as a possibility with Nixon, and it's happened with Trump. But here are the two guys who most explicitly abuse their power. I don't know whether that's actually true of the two. There are some abuses that have been overlooked over time. But what do you think of the practical consequences of the court coming down either way on this?
Well, I mean, I think the core conservative insight is that things can always get worse. Mm-hmm. And when you have political weapons to hand, you know, if they're the gun is on the table, it will get used. And so it's not just, I think, that it has a chilling effect on presidents if they're afraid that whatever they do, they could be prosecuted after they leave office. It's also a kind of liberating effect that the current president can go after his mm-hmm. predecessors if he decides that it's politically advantageous to do so. So I think that there are risks on both sides of the question. I do think the most implausible position here is that there's a presidential immunity that is both entirely implicit in the Constitution and absolute, which is, of course, the position that Trump himself has been pushing through his Truth Social posts.
Next question to you, Charlie. The Supreme Court will grant presidents some form of immunity from post-presidential prosecution, yes or no?
I think it's inevitable they'll grant some because they aren't going to want to upend everything the court has said in the last few decades. And so there will be some. But Trump's not going to get what he wants.
Maddie?
I think a majority will find that Trump is immune from prosecution for actions that are part of his official duties. But the question of what counts as official versus private, I think, will be kicked back to the lower courts.
Ramesh?
Yeah, they'll go down the middle, but in a messy way, and there will be a splintered majority.
So I'm going to double barrel this one, actually, now that I think of it. Charlie, there will be a January 6th trial before the election, yes or no?
No.
Maddie?
No, I don't think there will be time.
Ramesh?
Nope. consensus.
No, so I would say there'll be a split the baby decision from the Supreme Court. It'll be complex and nuanced, and there will not be a January 6th trial before the election, which is kind of incredible. And the other side is going to be apocalyptic about it, because this is, they've put so many eggs in this basket and put the Supreme Court in a very awkward position, because they'll get slammed for supposedly doing Trump's bidding. But this is what happens when you pursue a politicized prosecution on a political timetable involving a former president with all sorts of fraught legal questions that haven't been addressed before. With that, let's go to our first sponsor this episode. This is a message from Patriot Voices. Here's a simple thought. Parents matter. After all, who knows what's better for children, their parents or bureaucrats? Do you know what's best for your child, or do bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. have your child's best interests at heart? The answer is obvious. Parents matter. Right now, Congress is advancing a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act. This bill would strip parents of their decision-making authority if bureaucrats at the Federal Trade Commission decide that a Christian video or homeschooling site is dangerous or unscientific. Your family won't be able to access that material on the internet. Kids will be banned from seeing content online that the government deems dangerous, but the government's definition of what poses a threat to your child very likely is not your definition. If you believe parents matter, join Patriot Voices in opposing this takeover of parents' authority. Go to patriotvoices.com for more information and to take action. Again, that's patriotvoices.com, because parents matter. So, Maddie, we've had more drama unspooling on college campuses. So Columbia, the encampments are still there. There are negotiations going on between the protesters and the administration. The Senate, meanwhile, faculty Senate, was going to censure the president of Columbia. Now it's like, maybe we won't go there, because that will really undermine her position and lead to her firing, and maybe we don't want that. Meanwhile, and other this has continued to spread at other places, but a lot of other places have moved quickly. Princeton, very notably, the kids set up an encampment, and there is an announcement, you know, this is your first warning, you got to take this down, and they took it down immediately. Now they're still staging some sort of sit-in, but it's kind of a mixed picture. You got a mixed bag, you got the stuff spreading, but you also have some administrations doing the right thing. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so I think in a way, other schools other than Columbia have had time to figure out how they're going to deal with this and perhaps learn from Columbia's mistakes. And certainly the school has the apparatus to deal with this. And actually, they can sort of sidestep some of the controversy by saying, look, we have school policies. Like, you can't, this is actually trespassing at a certain point. You need to clear off this ground. This is a universally applied rule. This is what they can say, at least, and they can sort of sidestep the controversy. That obviously has not happened at Columbia. I mean, at Columbia now you have the situation where students have filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the school, saying that they've been discriminated against, which is just a kind of astonishing lack of self-awareness. And this complaint, they're saying that the school's actively contributed to pervasive racism and discrimination against Palestinian students on campus, causing both mental and physical harm. I know we've talked about the fact that on the one hand these people have a concept of safety and their own safety, which includes even having their feelings hurt, but on the other hand they just do not extend this at all to quote unquote Zionists, anybody who they perceive to be as in support of Israel, and obviously that is disproportionately affecting Jewish students and jeopardizing their mental physical safety. I think that the lessons to be learned from this are that you just have to act firmly, clearly, and quickly.
Yep.
When these things pop up, nip it in the bud, because if you don't, you just have complete chaos, and it's very embarrassing, and you know, really causes issues for the leadership.
Yeah, you're really caught in the middle the way the president of Columbia has been. So Charlie, well, first of all, the idea that Columbia would discriminate against Palestinian students, I mean, it's the last thing Columbia would do. I mean, all those administrators would rather kill their own mothers than discriminate against Palestinian students. It's inherently absurd. But Charlie, you had this group of academics signing a letter, I think more than 1,400, saying that Colombia has gone way too far in cracking down on these students, and they need to revoke all the punishments. You know, some of them have been suspended. The ones that were arrested last week were suspended, and their student cards don't work anymore. Or at least they were rendered inoperative for a while there. But this is, you know, a lot of these academics and faculty are just on the side of these protesters.
The opposite's the case. They haven't gone far enough. What they should have done is what Ben Sasse has done at the University of Florida, which, by the way, has more Jewish students, I think, than any other university in the United States, which is lay out proactively what constitutes free speech and what does not, and explain ahead of time what the punishments will be for those who go further than their First Amendment rights allow. They didn't do that. They didn't do that for a couple of reasons, but the first one, as you say, is that they agree with those who are protesting, or at least they are scared of being criticized by them. They're wounded when they're lumped in with the bad guys. Now, this analogy is slightly over the top because, of course, not everyone engaged in these protests are small children, although sometimes it's hard to distinguish. But when you're a parent and your children are being bad, you have to not care what they say about you. If your seven-year-old says, "Daddy, I hate you," you don't say, "Oh, no, whatever you want then. Why don't you pick the knife back up?" You say, "I don't care. Go to your room." And that, unfortunately, is one of the things that it takes to be a leader, to be in charge. That is to be disliked, to be called names, to be the man. There is a arrested development in so many people within our elite institutions in that they are the establishment. They are one of the most powerful establishments there has ever been, but they want to be the rebels. They want to be the counterculture. They see themselves still as the students in the equation. And so at Columbia, they won't do anything concrete about it. They let it spin out of control. It's partly ideological, of course. It's partly that they agree with them. It's mostly that they just don't want to be the teacher in the situation. Mm-hmm. And we see this elsewhere.
They're not comfortable being the man.
Right. And we see this elsewhere. We've seen this at the New York Times. That is what happened with the Tom Cotton op-ed. We've seen this at The Atlantic. We've seen this at MSNBC, where those who are supposed to be in charge just decline to be because they're desperate to be loved. Well, you're not going to be loved as the president of Columbia, especially if you have a whole bunch of students on campus who think that an integral part of the college experience is protesting, because at some point someone's going to go too far and you're going to have to tell them that. And they just won't do it. They're just not in charge. It probably helps Ben Sasse enormously that he went into this job as evil Republican senator, because he doesn't care. He's heard it all before.
Yeah.
And so he puts out these missives, and they work.
Ramesh.
So one thing that I think deserves a little bit more comment is just the sheer absurdity of the conceit of the protests, which is that Columbia University or Princeton University is in some meaningful way, you know, committing genocide.
Right.
It's, I mean, you know, even if one were to accept that characterization of Israeli policy, the nexus between that and the and these campuses and their investments is so it's just non-existent, and it's a way of these students inserting themselves into this incredibly large, important story and making it about themselves.
Yeah. They make it sort of a safe space drama. You know, this conflict, you know, thousands of miles away, involves them in their safety, because Columbia has some extremely, extremely attenuated connection to it, supposedly.
And I do also agree that, you know, administrators need to insist on kind of time, place, and manner restrictions on speech that allow the campuses to function as campuses, and they need to do it early and preemptively. I think that that general, you know, I think that this should involve the use of law enforcement less than it should the use of academic sanctions, such as suspension and expulsion. Now, you can reach a point where you've got so many people participating in these things that you've, you know, lost control of the situation. But in that, in those cases, you find the ringleaders, and they're the ones who you impose the sanctions on. And then going forward, you say, you know, anybody who disrupts campus life is going to be subject to these penalties. Now, where I do think that
sorry to interrupt, Ramesh, but it just seems to me, if one student somewhere is expelled, whoever it is, wherever it is, for whatever, that will have a huge suppressant on these protests, right? Because being arrested, maybe Jeff Blahar pointed this out, is kind of a credential in some ways, right? Especially if no real consequences flow from it. But if you're expelled, that's what they fear. And if there's just a remotely credible threat, that just seems the key disciplinary stick.
Yeah, I think that is exactly right. And but where I think that there is a free speech issue, a potential one, if you look at what happened at the University of Texas at Austin, I do think that the administrators and public officials need to be pretty clear about these things. And it's one thing, you know, so the campus administration did say, basically, you can't disrupt the campus. I do think Governor Abbott muddied the waters when he added to this, anti-Semitism will not be tolerated, which is a perfectly fine sentiment in itself, but not when paired with a crackdown on protests. Because, you know, it's just, anti-Semitism is, in fact, is terrible. But people can't be arrested for expressing anti-Semitic views.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, as Maddie was started with at the top of this conversation, the rules against trespass and encampments kind of provide an easy way out for at least a lot of what we've seen, because you don't need to get into parsing, you know, which chant or what kind of expression is violating the rules. So, Maddie, exit question to you. The protesters have advanced their cause the last couple of weeks or damaged their cause?
Well, if their cause is just to create as much chaos as possible, then certainly they've advanced it. But if their cause is to win hearts and minds, then definitely not.
Ramesh?
Depends on the reaction of Democratic Party elites. If it makes them think they've got to work harder to appease their left, then they will have succeeded. I think that would be the wrong lesson to draw. That doesn't mean they won't draw it.
What are the early indications, early returns on what conclusion they're drawing?
Well, I just think in general, there has been too much focus on the part of the Democrats for their own political interests on the left, and not enough on the center and right.
Mm-hmm. But there have been a fair number of condemnations of this stuff from Democrats. And in the White House, its initial statement was good, even though Biden kind of very fine peopled it when he had that press gaggle
right
the other day. Charlie, advancing or damaging?
I think Ramesh is right. I think it depends where this eventually goes within the Democratic Party, which is inextricable from our elite culture. And I think that might depend in large part on who wins the presidential election. Because if Trump wins, there will be voices, as with Abigail Spanberger on Defund the Police, who scream at Democrats about this and say, don't do that again. But if they win, they'll just assume, well, it didn't matter, perhaps even helped.
Yeah, I think they're damaging their cause with the broader public, and probably also on this issue that you and Ramesh are honing in on where the Democratic Party is. I think for the left's purposes, you know, voting non-affiliated, whatever it is, in Michigan is much more effective than this stuff, which I think freaks out a lot of Democrats because they realize the reaction. They realize how it looks in the reaction of the general public to this kind of thing. With that, Let's go to our second sponsor this episode. If you're considering the pros and cons of different cookware brands, you should know that Maiden has more of the pros. Pros like Tom Colicchio, Nancy Silverton, Brooke Williamson, and many other professional chefs who all trust their cooking to Maiden cookware. Fact is, Maiden has a long-standing relationship with professional chefs. The company evolved from a 100-year-old kitchen supply business and works with multi-generational makers to craft each piece. They make exactly what demanding chefs are looking for, including a wide selection of curated products from carbon steel to stainless clad, plus plateware, glassware, and more. But perhaps the biggest pro is that Maiden is sold online and delivered to your door, all for a fraction of the price of other top brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, invest in Maiden cookware. Once you try it, you'll be pro Maiden too. And I say this as someone who is pro Maiden. We have a number of Maiden pans in our kitchen here, and they really are exquisitely crafted pieces. You just pick them up and you just tell that this is something that is really made in a wonderful way. They cook evenly. They're easy to clean. They are a joy to work with. And right now, editors, listeners, get 10% off full-priced items from Maiden. For full details, visit maidencookware.com/editors. That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com/editors. Please check it out. I assure you, you will not regret it. So, Maddie, let's start with you. Again, we have this new Title IX rule from the Biden administration. This is one of the areas that's become like environmental law, where whoever comes into office, they'll just reverse what their predecessors did. And hugely consequential matters that you think Congress should be writing legislation that determines these things. But the administrative state is so extensive and sweeping, just really important things could be done unilaterally by the executive. Betsy DeVos, one of her foremost accomplishments, was writing Title IX rules that reversed the excesses and outrages of the Obama era. But lo and behold, they're back now with more of an emphasis on trans insanity. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so the Biden administration, much like the Obama administration, likes to downplay just how radical and sweeping these rules are. So during the Obama era, they did a lot of this through Dear Colleague letters. You know, it was sort of like under the radar, at least that was the intention. And during the Obama era, people hadn't fully got to grips with just what the trans movement was and what its demands were. That's not really going to fly this time with Biden. Certainly, he's attempted similar things. So in releasing these rules, they tried to suggest that they were sidestepping the issue of athletics. That's completely disingenuous, not least because elsewhere, the Biden Department of Justice has filed a statement of interest showing that its interpretation of Title IX is that the text already means that you have to include males who identify as female in female sports. So it's just completely disingenuous, but it does betray a level of awareness of where the public's at, especially with the sports issue. So what the new rules do, among many other things, because they really are incredibly sweeping, is they redefine sex-based discrimination to include gender identity. And what does that mean? Well, it means that basically every educational entity across the states that is in receipt of any amount of federal funding is now prohibited from acknowledging biological reality, the biological reality of sex, whenever individuals dispute it. So whenever they claim transgender status. So that affects women's sports spaces, scholarships. I mean, and it's not just college as well. It's K right through college. So yeah, I mean, it's completely devastating. And then there's the due process issue as well, which Betsy DeVos did a great job in kind of making due process protections more robust to kind of deal with this problem of Obama era kangaroo courts. And so the new rules give this incredibly expansive definition of sex-based harassment, which actually could quite easily be applied to using sex-based pronouns instead of somebody's preferred pronouns. So you could get in a situation where somebody could quote unquote misgender somebody and then be investigated for sex-based harassment and sort of be treated as though they're a sex offender. There's parental rights that are going to be affected as well in terms of schools transitioning kids behind parents' backs. So really, really devastating stuff, and all presented within this disingenuous language of moderation when it's anything but.
Yeah. So Charlie, I wrote a fairly big piece a couple weeks ago on what Trump's threat to democracy is, sort of concluding it's not, there's some bad things, including he's not going to accept the result if he loses, but it's not as dire as some people portray it. And I was talking to a very smart friend known to all of us, and he's saying, you know what, it's not really that he's a threat to democracy, and that's not what the left is really getting at. It's more like he's a threat to liberalism, you know, neutral application of the rules and that sort of thing. But you look at this, and like even liberalism, the left can't say, oh yeah, that's what we favor, right? Because you know, due process, all these things are just thrown out the window when they collide with their ideological passions.
Well, how long have you got? Well, this is our moment, isn't it? And it's distressing that the right has a faction within it that is not only manifested in the form of Donald Trump that wishes to go in that direction too. It does. But it's not alone, and it's one of the most frustrating parts of our politics to me, that insofar as illiberal tactics or approaches are condemned, they are condemned only in one direction by those who are willing to do it. I've had the most annoying experience in my time calling out executive overreach, which, as you know, and anyone who listens to this podcast will know, I have been doing for 13 years, assiduously.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever I write that the current president is doing a bad thing, is ignoring Congress, is circumventing the process, I get pats on the back from the people who don't like that president, and then white-hot anger if I mention, even in passing, that the last guy did it too. That we have created a continuum on which this behavior exists. People loved it when I pointed out that Trump was stealing the money from the Treasury for his border wall, that he'd asked Congress over and over and over and over for it, but then clearly decided to go it alone. But even in the course of doing that, you mentioned DACA. Oof, no, that's different. It's not different. And this isn't either. The unilateral rewriting of law is a threat to the American way of life. The people are, to a large extent, their constitutional order. And leave aside other factors such as instability, we are supposed to have systems that allow the aggregation of political opinion and channel it, and change therefore occurs over time. But that's not what we have at the moment. What we have is this wild seesawing where Congress sits on its hands, which it's allowed to do. There's nothing in the Constitution that says Congress has to act, or that if it doesn't act, something else happens. And the presidents we elect move in one direction or another. And this Title IX change, which is sweeping, which has serious effects for millions of people, is another good example of it, irrespective of the merits, which of course I think are crazy. I think the idea that we would use an executive order to upend the way our colleges work on the basis of a gender identity theory that is deeply unpopular in the country and that was arrived at about 7 minutes ago should highlight the problem here. But even if you love this and think that this is what America was contrived for, that the glint in the eye of James Madison in the late 18th century was exactly this moment, you should not want it to be done like this with all the resultant litigation and anger.
So, Ramesh, is there any solution here beyond just the ping-ponging and seesawing back and forth? Just win the election and reverse what the other guy has done?
Well, you know, it's worth thinking about this in light of the classic argument for a strong executive, you know, which is Hamilton's, and you know, everybody remembers Hamilton saying, "We need to have energy in the executive." I think that the next sentence, or maybe two sentences later, he offers as an explanation for one of the reasons you really need energy in the executive is steady administration of the laws. But here we have an expansion of executive power in our day that leads to the opposite of that. The, as you said, the ping-ponging.
Right.
Administration.
Hyper-energetic executive.
Yeah, spastic. The spastic executive. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think one thing you do need is a court system that will police these sorts of opportunistic interpretations of the law by the executive branch. And we may be on the verge of getting more of that kind of policing. You know, we're certainly going to see a lot of litigation about this issue. But, you know, it's just... This was a chance for the administration to strike a simultaneous blow against freedom, the rule of law, and biology. And so how could they pass it up? Yeah.
So, Maddie, there is litigation already, correct?
Right, yeah. So there's the Independent Women's Law Center has legislation, a lawsuit ready to go. We got warning of this because the proposed rules were released in 2022. So, and there, what's even though there's been a period where they've had to take comments, they've clearly not taken on board any of the comments skeptical of transgender ideology. So it's pretty much as we thought it was going to be, and there's a lawsuit in the works. And honestly, I think that lawsuit is very likely to win. I mean, this is just unconstitutional on a number of levels.
So Charlie, I ask a question to you. Rate your outrage over this new Title IX rule from 0, it's no big deal, 10, thermonuclear.
Well, it's pretty high because it combines the executive lawmaking that I abhor with a bad policy. But I ought to record that if this were going through Congress, I would be strongly against it, but I would also understand that Congress were amending its own law.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's no reason okay. Congress can't do this, right? I mean,
well, there is a reason, and that's that it probably wouldn't have the votes.
Yeah.
Or at least it wouldn't have lawmakers who want to be on the record having voted for it in an election year.
Yeah. When I say do this, I meant kind of just write into law whatever the rules and interpretations of them are. But you're right. Yeah. This would never pass.
I mean, look, Rich, I know you're agreeing with me, so forgive the way I'm about to put this, but what you just asked me was, there's no reason that Congress shouldn't engage in lawmaking, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
that's the extent to which we are now in trouble, we are astonished when we see Congress exercising the power that Article 1 says is vested exclusively within its jurisdiction.
Yeah, it's gotten just so weird. It was the same smart friend I was mentioning earlier, who's very smart and has a lot of insights. But he was saying it's just, you know, his experience when he was working at the White House is that members of Congress and senators would come and petition the White House to do something. And then if the White House did it, they'd go home and brag and say, look, I got the White House to unilaterally apply this rule. So it's become this perverse thing where your role as a legislature is in part just lobbying the executive to do your own job. And there's this profound just lack of institutional self-respect that would have shocked James Madison and company.
Yeah, I remember there was a senator that I liked who was giving the attorney general at the time grief for enforcing the marijuana laws. And the same senator hadn't done anything to change the marijuana laws. Mm-hmm. It was just
So your level of outrage, Ramesh, from 0 to 10?
I would say about 8, and I do think that the usurpation of authority is worse when it's more consequential. And in this case, you're dealing with, I think, a pretty destructive cultural trend that's that's having a really bad effect, particularly on kids.
Maddie, you got to be a 10, Maddie.
Yeah, I am a 10. I just think this is so devastating for women, for kids, for parents. And on top of all that, it's done by such a flagrantly unconstitutional means. So yeah, I'm pretty outraged.
Yeah, it's all very bad. I'll go with Ramesh's 8. So with that, let's hear from our final sponsor of this episode. Our friends at the Competitive Enterprise Institute have all new episodes of their breakout Free the Economy podcast. If you're not already listening to the show, Free the Economy is a weekly podcast hosted by Richard Morrison that explores opportunities for financial success and self-fulfillment in a world with less government control. Each episode host, Richard Morrison, offers news and analysis on the economy and fascinating conversations with experts on topics ranging from the future of artificial intelligence to the perils of a central bank digital currency. Think of the podcast as big ideas meets real world application in ways that makes our economy happier, healthier, and wealthier. So check out Free the Economy wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CEI.org/free the economy. That's CEI.org/free the economy. So with that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Maddie, you've been rewatching Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. So this is probably something I do every few years, which is maybe too much in some people's views, but we're currently watching the third, the Return of the King, and we're doing it in two installments because they're pretty long. But I've realized I know what each character is going to say before he says it, and sometimes I even say it out loud, which is I think very annoying for my husband. But yeah, they're just such great movies and sort of timeless as well, even though we've obviously advanced in CGI and special effects, but you still just, they're just classics.
So Maddie, maybe it's unfair, but I just, those movies for me, they all kind of run together. And the image I have in my mind is just these massive fights between orcs and various things.
Yeah. I mean, they definitely do run together. I mean, they're three part of one, but certainly I think each battle is distinct, and certainly there's a big difference between the battle at Helm's Deep, which is just, I think, incredibly entertaining. And then the final battle where, the good guys have their trump card with the dead army sweeping in at the end. And I think there's so much there. It's not too long for me, although it would be too long if I was to try watch it all in one sitting.
Mm-hmm. So Ramesh, you've been reading René Girard.
That's right. So every year I try to take up a little religious reading during Lent, and every year I don't actually do it until after Lent is over. And I'm reading I See Satan Fall Like Lightning, his celebrated work from 1999, which has become a big deal in certain circles in the last few years because Peter Thiel has been promoting Girardianism. And so far it's,
what is that? What is,
well,
what is,
you know, that? I'm in the middle of the book, so I'm going to have to come back when I've actually okay. finished it and reporting it. And then I'll report on it, but it's a short book, so it shouldn't be too long, but it's a kind of, attempt to present a kind of key to all mythologies. But it's quite grippingly done. And, but although, you know, possibly more so if you start out as a Christian.
Charlie.
So
maybe we should add it to the Christian books you need to read, Charlie. Right after The City of God, you can I can pick this one up.
I'll get to it eventually, I suppose. But not if I keep watching sports. I've been very determinedly trying not to add another sport to those in which I'm interested.
Hockey. But please tell me it's hockey.
Yeah, yeah. I went to a friend's house the other night, and he had the Rangers game on, and I started asking questions, and I'd never really got into it before. Now, of course, every time I mention this to anyone, they all immediately say the same thing. Oh, you can't watch it on TV. It's so much better in person, which I'm sure is true. But even on TV, I actually found myself starting to get into it. So,
good. It's a great sport. Just don't become a Rangers fan. Become a Panthers
fan. Yeah. Well, I'm not saying I'm a Rangers fan, but if I don't show up on this podcast on Tuesday, you'll know my wife has murdered me as a result of this.
So I finished reading this Ian Kershaw biography of Hitler. It's the second volume. I read the first volume a long time ago when it first came out. I reviewed it for National Review. Actually, and this is the second volume encompassing World War II. And I have to say, it's one of the best history books I've ever read. It's long, it's 800 pages. I'm a bit of a skimmer. I don't read quotes, parentheticals, or anything within dashes unless it's a particularly compelling passage. But and this is not, he's not a great stylist, Kershaw, but he's a crisp writer, clean writer. So the book has some narrative force, and just his judgment seems, I'm not an expert on Nazism or Hitler, but his judgment seemed quite authoritative, and just the events, of course, are just, you know, so horrifying and fascinating. It's really a tremendous book. Sometimes I just mention books that I've read that aren't so great, and I fear my friend Alec is going to go and pick them up. But this is one that he and others really should pick up if you have any interest in this era. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Maddie Kearns, what's your pick?
I really enjoyed Charlie's review of Manhunt. Charlie sometimes says that he's not a great film reviewer. I don't know what he's talking about, but this was very, very enjoyable. I also really appreciate it because I recently finished reading Gone with the Wind, and so I have been watching the Ken Burns Civil War documentary, so I think Manhunt might be next on our to-watch list.
That's a lot of watching, Maddie.
I know, yeah.
Ramesh, what's your pick?
Well, it's so hard to select something from the new issue of National Review, but I would suggest people pick up Dan McLaughlin's article on the 1892 election, what it has in common with our own. I can promise you, you'll never need to read anything about 1892 again.
Charlie.
So actually, you know what I want to choose? Although I was involved in it, what I want to choose is my podcast this week, because it was a debate between Noah and MBD. It was an extended version of the debate we started on this podcast. And we ran out of time, but I wanted to know what MBD and
how it
Noah
ended, how the debate ended.
Yeah, I wanted to hear the end of the debate. And so I thought, well, I have the capacity to speak this into existence. So I asked them to come onto my podcast this week and to at length explain their opposing positions on funding for Ukraine. So although it sounds like I'm picking my own thing, but not really, because I just essentially shut up and let them talk.
Yeah, as we expected, the reaction to the foreshortened version of the debate on the editors has been very positive. People love these kind of discussions, and they should definitely check out the long form version on your podcast, Charlie. So my pick is Abigail Anthony's coverage of the student protest, and in particular, her coverage of the protest at Princeton. She's an alum of Princeton, but she reported on this document that the students preparing to set up the encampment had that referred to the legal help they were getting and how they had no expectation of punishment. And it wouldn't surprise me if this item actually helped prompt the administration to act swiftly to break up the encampment right after it started. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, Ramesh. Thanks to Patriot Voices Made In and the Free the Economy podcast. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors, and we'll see you next time.